So, that was Autonoma Tanzhilfe by MC Murrow. Now, welcome back to Talking Science, where scientific truth is traded below market value. I'm Boyang, pretending to be your host for the next half an hour, or less. Talking Science is a leading and currently only science program on campus radio that crawls the web for cutting-edge scientific discoveries and technological innovations and copy and edit them into digestible sound bites for your convenience. A lot of copyright has been infringed. I hope nobody sues me. So last week, we cliffhanged, if that's a word, at Octopus Eye. Following that, we want to present you a new podcast curated by the Institut für Philosophie der Universität Wien. We think our readers could fortify their mind through engagement with philosophical issues, and the podcast is a promising side of practice. Of course, we'll also continue with non-breaking news like religiosity of the menstruation cycle, fossilized giant sperms, the exponential growth of academic output, how ocean's acidity kills oyster babies, and last, an important dating advice from the conversation. So last week, we talked about a new study published in Nature Scientific Reports, where researchers found that despite belonging to completely different lineages, eyes of humans and octopus evolved through tweaks to the same gene. The gene involved is a paired box gene, PEX6. In order for the gene to work, the DNA encoding the gene needs to be read and copied into a different kind of code. The other code is called RNA. RNA code is interesting in that it can be edited. One kind of editing called splicing removes one piece from the middle of the code and stitches the two ends together. The marvel of splicing is that it can be used to produce two different kinds of instructions from the same piece of RNA code. So RNA made from the PEX6 can be spliced in just such a manner as many other genes. As a consequence, two different kinds of instructions can be generated from the same PEX6 RNA. Not only two, probably hundreds of different kinds of instructions can be generated from a gene using, or from one single piece of gene using splicing. Whether that's the case in PEX6, I don't know, but it must be. It's probably more than two different kinds of instructions. So in the new study, the researchers found that PEX6 RNA splicing has been used to create a camera eye in a surprising lineage. So it occurs in the lineage that includes squid, cuttlefish, and octopus, the cephalopoda. Cephalopoda have a camera eye with the same features as the vertebrate camera eye, so ORAS. Importantly, the cephalopod on camera eye arose completely independently from ORAS. And the last common ancestor of octopus and vertebrates of humans existed more than 500 million years ago, which is even longer than the average duration of a student at GKE requires to finish his or her degree. So PEX6 RNA splicing in cephalopods is a wonderful demonstration of how evolution fashions equivalent solutions via entirely different routes. And using analogous structures, evolution can provide remarkable innovations. The Institut für Philosophie at University of Vienna has been experimenting with podcasting for a while. So for the German listeners, if anyone is listening, here's some philosophical musing on ice beers and strawberries.
guten Abend. Wie wir alle wissen, haben es die Eisbären nicht leicht. Ihre Situation hat sich auch nicht verbessert, seitdem sich die internationale Gemeinschaft dazu entschlossen hat, tatenlos dabei zuzusehen, wie die Erdbären die Macht an sich reißen. In der darauf folgenden Literatur wurde vermehrt das Stimmrecht für die Eisbären zur Sprache gebracht, denn die Diktatur der Erdbären ließ kein Haar an ihren Kernen. Was führte dazu, dass früchtetragende Sträucher in der Arktis angepflanzt wurden? Das Futter wurde knapp. Um dem Chaos ein Ende zu bereiten, wurde von Seiten der UNO eine Eingreiftruppe entsandt. Bei den darauf folgenden schweren Kampfhandlungen fanden 14 Eisbären, 33 Erdbären und mehrere Dutzend involvierte Soldaten den Tod. Seitdem herrschen bürgerkriegsähnliche Zustände.
Ja, heute ein Jahr danach ist die Situation verfahrener denn je. Menschen werden auf der Straße einerseits mit faulen Erdbeeren, andererseits mit verhungerten Eisbären beworfen. Selbstmordanschläge stehen dabei an der Tagesordnung. Wir fragen uns da, wer sind die Schuldigen? Und wir alle wissen es, sind die Rot-Blau-Stifte. Ihre Macht gehört gebrochen. Sie bestimmen das gesellschaftliche Leben auf allen Ebenen und brachten den Konflikt im Norden zum Eskalieren. Ich bedanke mich für Ihre Aufmerksamkeit. Herzlichen Dank, dass Sie eingeschaltet haben. Wir sehen uns demnächst.
So, I hope it wasn't too sophisticated or intellectual for you to understand. That was from podcasts.philo.at. That is podcasts.phila.at. The next is a narration of two cousins running a shellfish farm. And the problems they encountered due to the ocean's rising acidity that are likely caused by the high level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. CO2 reacts with water to carbonic acid and decreases ocean's pH. And how that affects oyster fishes, affects oysters, you will hear in the following. If I can get the plate back.
So we're cousins. Our dads are Bill Taylor and Paul Taylor, and they run Taylor Shellfish.
And I'm Brittany Taylor.
And this is Deani Taylor.
That too.
And we're the fifth generation of our family to
work for our family business.
I really take pride in the fact that our company is part of a big community, and it's very family-like. We have many families, not only mine, but many other families that have their whole families that work for us.
The ocean is so acidic that it is dissolving the shell of our baby oysters. Our farm is what has kept this family together. It's our glue. I can't imagine it would be devastating to lose that, such a big part of our history. When we started farming oysters, over 100 years ago, we relied on the natural reproduction of oysters in the bay to occur in order to get our oysters. But as the industry has changed, we started cultivating our own oyster larvae, our own baby oysters. So when we started doing that, we needed something like our hatchery, which is a kind of like a greenhouse where you can raise up the baby shellfish and the baby oysters to get big enough so that we can go and plant them on our beaches.
It took us a while to figure out what was happening in our hatcheries relating to ocean acidification, just because there's so many different things that can happen to make seed not survive. One of the things the hatcheries realized was that the clams and oysters were having problems forming their shell. So that made them look at the pH levels, because that kind of accounts for it. Shellfish is very vulnerable when it's first being created, and it's the acidity in the water that makes it hard for them to form their shells.
So when it reaches the baby oysters in the first few days of life, that acidic water actually will dissolve the shell, which is calcium, and if they don't make it through the first few weeks of its life when it's being affected by ocean acidification, then we have no oysters to plant on our beach. So it's something that we truly experience and deal with on a day-to-day basis. It's not something that's going to happen potentially in 5 or 10 years. Along the coast of Oregon, there's a specific function called upwelling, where deeper water is coming up towards the surface. And it's that deeper water that is the acidic water. We don't know how bad ocean acidification is going to get. We're just starting to experience the consequences of it. What we're experiencing here in the Puget Sound is what other people will be experiencing not too long in the future.
I definitely want to be able to pass on our business onto the next generation.
Yeah, it'd be fun to share that experience with the next generation like our dads shared with us.
So that was from Life Science. Did you notice how the narrators sometimes uptalk, so they raise intonation at the end of the sentence, if the statement is not a question sentence? Well, they are from Washington State on the Pacific side of the United States, where I think this kind of uptalk is quite widespread especially among women. Anyway. Next story from Nature's News Blog, who are probably most qualified to discuss the following topic. Apparently, it's a common complaint among academics, one that I haven't heard yet, that today's researchers are publishing too much and too fast, and just how fast is the mass of scientific output actually growing? Well, bibliometric analysts Lutz Bronnmann at the Max Planck Society in Munich, Germany, and Rüdiger Mutz at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zürich, the Eidgenössische Technische Hochschule, they think they have a better answer. It is impossible to know for sure, but the rate is close to 8 to 9% each year, they argue. So that equates to a doubling of global scientific output roughly every 9 years. In a study to be published in the Journal of the Association for Information Science and Technology and uploaded to the online server archive, Bronnmann and Mutz find that global scientific output has probably kept up this dazzling rate of increase since the end of World War II. The authors write that there are three growth phases in the development of science, which each led to growth rates tripling in comparison with the previous phase, so from less than 1% up to the middle of the 18th century, to 2 to 3% up to the period between the two world wars, and 8 to 9% to 2012. Bronnmann and Mutz take an ingenious approach to estimating total scientific output. They define it as any reference, including not just papers but also books, datasets, and websites, subsequently cited by another academic publication in the Web of Science database. Yes, Web of Science is quite a large database containing references to many papers and apparently also books and datasets. It also includes social sciences and arts and humanities, which is a very broad and generous definition of science, quote unquote. By analyzing more than 755 million cited references in 38 million publications from 1980 to 2012, they totted up all publications from 1650 onwards that were ever cited, so cited after 1980, the rates of increase are similar even if publications are limited to just the natural sciences or just health and medicine. Of course, the approach misses out publications that were never subsequently cited, but a publication that is never cited may be regarded as practically useless and uncountable, unless it happens to appear in a very selective and obscure database. This estimate is, of course, extremely rough for other reasons. It is bedeviled by the aging effect, which means that very old papers are less likely to be mentioned by academics publishing from the 1980s onwards, and because some of the literature will be multiply counted despite the researchers' best efforts. Concerning the aging effect, especially in biology, I think the most cited paper in biology is the one on the BLAST method, which is a method to find genetic alignments. But actually, the paper that should be most cited is the paper which outlines, or the research by Fisher which outlines the p-value, because p-value is really a omnipresent term in all scientific papers, but it is often people just assume it, they never cite it, because that was published about 100 years ago, while BLAST has been published I think 20 or 30 years ago. So if Fisher was cited, he would be probably the most cited author in biology and psychology and statistics, obviously. So and the growth rates, the author have found out, don't look too different from earlier studies in the field. The basic argument goes all the way back to 1965, when the man widely regarded as the father of bibliometrics, Derek de Solla Price, similarly found an exponential increase in growth, which he did not quantify. But, well, so does this proliferation of papers represent regrowth of knowledge? Well, as Price noted, that he is tempted to conclude that a very large fraction of the alleged 35,000 journals now current, so that was in 1965, must be reckoned as merely a distant background noise and as very far from central or strategic in any of the knitted strips from which the cloth of science is woven. Very metaphorical. What he's saying is that, not anything that is published is worth the paper it is published on. And today's, so current salami slicing, in which scientists may pursue additional publications for career advancements, only adds to this effect. The behavior of scientists to publish more, to split up papers, so to publish first a short paper, followed by a more detailed one, and so on, which is that they slice up their research into different papers, that would imply an extra growth when you count the references and the number of papers published, but that is not necessarily real growth of science. It looks like I will not finish with today's script. I will go as far as I can, and as slowly and as clearly as I can. So from Science Daily, on a new study published in the journal Proceedings of the Royal Society B. Preserved giant sperm from tiny shrimps. Did I mention giant sperm? Yes, from tiny shrimps that lived at least 17 million years ago have been discovered at the River's Lay World Heritage fossil site by a team including University of New South Wales researchers from Australia. The giant sperm are thought to have been longer than the male's entire body, but are tightly coiled up inside the sexual organs of the fossilized freshwater crustaceans, which are known as ostracodes. These are so far the oldest fossilized sperm ever found in the geological record. The discovery of fossil sperm, complete with sperm nuclei, was totally unexpected. Microscopic study of fossils revealed they contain the preserved internal organs of the ostracoids, including their sexual organs. Within these are the almost perfectly preserved giant sperm cells, and within them, the nuclei that once contained the animal's chromosomes and DNA. Also preserved are the Zenke organs, pumps, used to transfer the giant sperm to the female. The researchers estimate the fossil sperm are about 1.3 millimeters long, about the same length or slightly longer than the animal itself. 1.3 milliliters, that would be visible with the naked eye. So about 17 million years ago, the site of discovery was a cave in the middle of a vast biologically diverse rainforest. Tiny shrimps, ostracoids, thrived in a pool of water in the cave that was continually enriched by the droppings of thousands of bats. The steady rain of poo from the bats in the cave would have led to high levels of phosphorus in the water, which could have aided the mineralization of the soft tissues. There's also a few examples of soft tissue preservation in fossil bat-rich deposits in France. So the key to eternal preservation of soft tissues may indeed be some magic ingredient in bat droppings. Well, now comes my advice from the conversation. Bringing flowers to your next date. Well, better look for your next date in or near a flower shop. Flowers are apparently inextricably linked with relationships. Well, you see, I also learned quite a great deal of new things during my research, apparently. But can the mere presence of flowers influence relationships, such as affecting dating prospects? Well, apparently they can, if we are to believe the results of experiments done by Nicolas Gengen at the University of Southern Brittany, France. In the first experiment, Gengen randomly assigned female participants to watch a video of a male discussing food, while participants were either sitting in a room decorated with three vases full of flowers, roses, marigolds, and daisies, or sitting in a room decorated with empty vases. Women who sat in the room with flowers rated the male in the video as sexier and more attractive, and they were more willing to date him. And next, Gengen assessed whether flowers would have the same effect when a flesh and blood male was involved. So he set up an experiment involving 100 male undergraduates and a man judged to be attractive. Well, a seasoned experimenter will immediately spot the crucial flaw in the setup. Who did the judging? Each of this come in, so the moderators of the next show are already in. But I guess I'm allowed to finish. Yeah, thank you. So each of the young women were led in turn to a room where the man was waiting, and the researcher welcomed them both as part of the study. Although unknown to the young men, the man was part of the experiment. The researcher then led them to separate rooms, where the woman watched the food video all the time, thinking the man was doing the same thing. Once the female participant had watched the video, she was collected by the researcher and led to the man's room, where they were told to discuss the video. And after allowing them to talk along for a few minutes, the researchers entered the room and asked them to wait for a few minutes while he printed off some questionnaires which they would both be asked to complete. So while he was away, the man, who used a script in order to have a similar interaction with each participant, engaging the young women in small talk, complimenting them like, "You seem very nice," and asking for their phone number. Some 80% of women who had watched the video in the room with flowers gave out their phone number, compared to half of women who had not sat in a room with flowers. And Gagan didn't stop here. He wanted to be sure that flowers really have a large impact on the outcome, so he ran another experiment, where an attractive male asked 600 young women, all of whom I want to be a participant in that experiment. Well, so 600 women, all of whom were walking along in a shopping mall for their phone number. However, the male didn't just make his request at any old place in the mall. He specifically asked for phone numbers either in front of a flower shop, flower store, a cake store, or a women's shop. Oh, I'm so excited that I can't even speak, apparently. Yeah, that's what science does to me. So, he asked for phone numbers either in front of a flower shop, a cake shop, or a shoe shop. And as predicted and consistent with the previous studies, the male was more successful in getting a woman's phone number when he asked her for it in front of a flower shop. And although he was rejected the majority of the time, he got lucky on 24% of occasions when he asked for the phone number in front of a flower shop, compared to a 15.5% success rate near the cake store and a 11.5% success rate near the shoe store. Yes, 20 bloody percent. I can only assume it's quite an attractive guy. So it seems, before I finish, well, I have to finish now because I have to go. I will continue next week. And you have to, of course, you have to listen to the end of it to know the full advice, which will help you to get a 25% successful rate or whatever. So that was this week's Talking Science. I hope you enjoyed it. And if not, sorry, Herbert, for disappointing you. I'll do better next time. Our next week, Thursday, is Campus Radio Promotion, sponsored by Red Bull, the drink that gives you wings. Wings here being a metaphor of your own choice. I'll be serving you ice cream in person, and you'll have the possibility to shake my hands. A singular opportunity not to be missed. Thank you for listening to Campus Radio. We'll play it out with some high-quality silence. I'm Bo Yang, and I hope that you'll tune in the same time next Tuesday.